So welcome to the talk by Phyllis Bennis. Thank you again for being here. I really appreciate it. So this is hosted by Emmanuel Peace Action. I'm the president, Michaela. And I'd like to introduce Phyllis Bennis. She is the director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute of Policy Studies. She's a writer, an analyst, and activist on Middle East and UN issues. She is also the co-founder United for Peace and Justice and the U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation, and co-chairs the UN-based International Coordinating Network on Palestine, as well as the author of Understanding ISIS and the New Global War on Terror. So I'd like to introduce Phyllis Bennis.
Well, thanks to Emmanuel and to Emmanuel Peace Action. This is a great chance to, I haven't been to Emmanuel before, so this is a great chance to see the school. And it's, I think, an important time for folks to be coming together to talk about the war in Syria and what it's a part of, the broader war that it's one part of, because things are going from bad to worse. Things are not getting better. And left to their own devices, our government and other governments are pretty sure to do the wrong thing rather than the right thing most of the time when it comes to these wars. So I think it's an important time to be talking about it. You know, it's difficult in a certain way to talk about the war in Syria, because the war in Syria is not a war, and it's not only in Syria, but it's part of a global war. We could identify what President Bush called the global war on terror, and the war that's raging in Syria is part of that war. The other complication is that the war in Syria is not a single war. The war in Syria is about 8 or 9 or 10 separate wars divided into two sections. So there's a civil war going on between the Syrian regime and part of its population that began, as you know, in the context of the Arab Spring in with a nonviolent uprising for asking for political reforms, quickly militarized when the regime clamped down with enormous brutality, was answered with a newly militarized movement, and morphed fairly quickly into civil war. But separate from that, there's a whole host of proxy wars being waged in Syria, whether it's between Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are looking for who's going to be the regional hegemon in terms of oil and military power and economic power and political power, and in terms of a sectarian war also between Iran and Saudi Arabia, whether Sunni or Shia Islam is going to be dominant in the region. Then there's wars of other forces. There's a war between the U.S. and Israel against Iran for all kinds of things. There's a war between the religious and many of them extremist, but not all, and the secular forces within the opposition. There's several wars between Turkey and the Kurds, and there's struggles between various Kurdish forces. All of these are being waged to the last Syrian, but most of them don't have anything to do with Syria and will not do any good for anybody in Syria. There's also a war going on that has been a Cold War up until now, but is rapidly heating up, and that's the war between the United States and Russia, which is getting worse and worse in Syria, and we're hearing very dangerous developments just in the last few days. The good news is that Secretary of State Kerry is trying once again to get talks underway. There's some plans for talks in Lausanne in Switzerland on Saturday. Nobody is too optimistic about those talks. And in the midst of those talks, we're also hearing about new escalations on all sides, military moves that are quite threatening when there's no talks underway and no easy way out for either of these giant superpowers overarmed with military and particularly nuclear weapons. So there's some very dangerous developments underway. And the urgency, therefore, for reaching some kind of negotiated ceasefire, arms deal, arms control, and ultimately diplomatic solution becomes more urgent than ever. So the context of all this, and I'll get into a little bit of the detail, not too much, but the context of it all is what President Bush called the global war on terror. Now you remember, some of you, most of you are too young to remember, but you've probably read about it. After 9/11, the day after, even the day of, we heard from President Bush there was a choice, that Americans had a choice. We could either go to war or let him get away with it. It was war or nothing. And since most people didn't want to just say, let him get away with it, do nothing, a lot of people supported war who might otherwise have been against it. Why would they have been against it? Well, to start with, none of the hijackers were from Afghanistan. None were Afghans. They were mainly Saudis and a couple of Egyptians. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't train in Afghanistan. They trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. So what were we doing bombing Afghanistan? Because they were inspired by somebody who was holed up in Afghanistan. But we also know that a big part of the reason for the war in Afghanistan, aside from revenge, despite the rhetoric, this was never a war for justice. This was a war for revenge. But it was also a war to prepare the political ground for a war in Iraq. Now, why? Because there were weapons of mass destruction. Oh, no, that's wrong. It's because Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. Oh, no, that's not quite right. Except a lot of people in this country still think that's true, because we were told it over and over and over again by people in Washington who most people in this country like to assume knew something more than we knew, had access to more information than we knew, or some version thereof. So the global war on terror is launched. And what we see is that the U.S. has been at war with terrorism for 15 years. And terrorism is doing just fine. Terrorism is thriving. The people and the cities and the countries where this so-called war against terrorism is being waged, they're not doing so well. People are being killed. Cities are being destroyed. The levels of instability and violence and chaos have escalated throughout an enormous and expanding region. Now, to his credit, and it's about the only thing I want to give him credit for here, President Bush understood what he was doing, and he called it a global war, exactly what it was. President Obama, when he was elected on a platform of ending what he called the dumb war in Iraq and promising, as he did, to expand the smart war in Afghanistan, something he did, that was a promise kept. I think too many people sort of skipped that part when they were looking at his anti-war credentials and saying, great, he's going to end the war in Iraq, and not looking at the other side of it. But on the second day after he came into office, the Obama administration sent out a memo to the White House and to the Pentagon and to the State Department, to, you know, pretty much everybody, saying, we would rather that you not call this the global war on terror. We would rather use the term overseas contingency operation. Now, it's pretty Orwellian. You know, it's this anodyne description, overseas operation. It's kind of, you know, the global fire truck getting the kitten out of the tree. When I heard it, I thought, well, that's what you do, like if you send the Navy to rescue people off the coast of Haiti who have been displaced from the hurricane. That's an overseas operation, right? This is a war, and he should call it a war. Now, it's not the same kind of war. It's quite different. It doesn't involve hundreds of thousands of ground troops, as George Bush's war did. But there is no question this is a war. Just ask anybody in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Djibouti or Somalia or Libya or any of these countries where these wars are being waged. So what we have is the continuation of a global war on terror, but one that is not identified as a full-scale war, despite the costs to the people and cities and countries where it's being waged, and ultimately the costs here at home in the discrediting of our government and our policies, in the financial costs, which I'll get to later. But we're seeing all of this at a moment when the U.S. is expanding militarism around the world. It isn't only in the war theater of the broader Middle East. It's also the militarization of foreign policy, where extreme sanctions that are crippling for ordinary people and military threats and the escalation of military capacities around the world take the place of a diplomatic focus for diplomacy, for foreign policy. So the irony is, of course, when we look at when, and we're hearing a lot now about President Obama's legacy, he's in his last few months of office, he's thinking about legacies, other people are writing about his legacy. He's got some things to be very proud of that are based on the triumph of diplomacy over war. He can point to the Iran nuclear deal, which was a hard-fought accomplishment against massive opposition in Congress, massive opposition from Israel, massive political opposition. But they got it through, and it's been a remarkably powerful, strong, negotiated deal. It has its problems, but it's avoided what was a potentially devastating war. He can point to Cuba, where after 50 years of crippling sanctions and a blockade, we're not all the way there yet. We don't have full normalization yet. But the U.S. is well on its way towards normalizing relations with Cuba. And all of that was done without firing a shot, eliminating the worst of the sanctions. Not all, but we're on the way. If you look at everywhere where the military has been the centerpiece of our policy, we've failed. And this global war on terror, it didn't just fail in some broad rhetorical sense. Yes, we've been at war with terror for 15 years and terrorism is doing just fine. I kind of like that line. It's quite accurate. But it isn't just that broad framework. It's also the failures you can point to in every one of those countries where that war has been waged. So start with Afghanistan, where we first went to war for the global war on terror. We've been having troops in Afghanistan from almost 60, well, it'll be 15 and a half years now. You know, it's an extraordinary thing. At the end of the day, what do we see in Afghanistan? We see massive failure. Just last week, the Central Command reaffirmed that as of now, the Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than at any time since the U.S. overthrew the Taliban back in 2001. Great. 15 years of occupation have done great. And then you hear, well, at least the girls can go to school. At least children can get an education, which they couldn't under the Taliban. Well, there were plenty of problems under the Taliban. It was a repressive, horrific, misogynistic regime, no doubt. But what we've got now in a government led by corrupt politicians and a bunch of warlords whose own religious and political views are very, very similar to those of the Taliban. We just heard from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan that over 42% of the children of Afghanistan have either never gone to school, or if they went at all, they were forced to leave school by the fifth grade at the most. Most have gotten no education at all. Why? Because most of the schools that were supposedly being built at enormous expense with our tax money by U.S.-paid contractors were simply never built at all. The few that were often collapsed in the first winter because they weren't built to withstand it, and they have no teachers. So the whole question of how the U.S. tried to operate in Afghanistan has been a fraud. It has accomplished nothing. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, Afghanistan was, according to UNICEF, the worst country in the world for a child to be born and survive to her first birthday, and the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive. Today, it's still the worst country in the world for a woman to, I shouldn't say today, this was about 6 months ago, it may have changed by now, but it was still the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive, and the second worst country in the world, Sierra Leone, came out ahead, if you will. So that's what we have to brag about after 15 years of military occupation. In Iraq, the next, if we go chronologically, the next country for the global war on terror, we see a government that is so incompetent that there is still only 6 or 7 hours of electricity for anybody in Baghdad and 4 or 5 or less for anybody else in the country. They've never been able to get the electricity working again after the war. And so incredibly sectarian as a Shia-dominated government and brutal in its treatment of the large Sunni minority that a ton of Sunni, ordinary Sunni Iraqis are turning to ISIS as the lesser evil. Not because they're extremists, not because they're religious fanatics. I mean, I've met some of these Sunni generals. They are as secular as they come. They drink, they smoke, God knows what else they do. But they are not religious anything. But they are turning to ISIS because they see it as the potential for maybe they could get some support, some defense of their community against a sectarian government put in place, armed and paid by the United States with our tax money, despite the fact that they're more accountable to Iran than they are to us. But that government has been so repressive against ordinary Sunnis, from roundups of young Sunni men on the streets, torture in the prisons, bombing of a Sunni nonviolent protest camp. It's been really grim. So people are turning to ISIS and saying, well, maybe that's where we could get some kind of hope, some kind of support against this government. It's been a complete failure. Yemen's the poorest country in the Arab world, has been for decades. 80% of the population now is completely dependent on food for survival from the United Nations. The economy has been destroyed. People are being held in towns that have been under siege by the Saudi-led coalition that is dropping bombs that we provide from planes that we provide that are fueled in the air by our planes and our pilots. And we read in the New York Times today that for the first time, the U.S. is engaging in the war in Yemen. And I wanted to yell at somebody at the Times and say, what do you think in-air refueling is? Chopped liver? You know, it's like, what are you people thinking? This is the first time. They have been engaged in this war for the entire 15 months this war has been waged. What they did do for the first time today, or I guess yesterday, was to directly bomb the rebel forces in Yemen who are fighting back against the Saudi coalition bombing, who tried to bomb a U.S. warship and failed, and the U.S. went and bombed Yemen and took out three targeting things of some sort. I'm not quite sure what they were. Radar systems on the Yemeni coast. So now the U.S. is clearly fully directly involved. It certainly isn't the first time, as I mentioned earlier. But it has been an absolute failure. The Saudi war has led to enormous civilian casualties. You all know about the bombing of the funeral parlor 3-4 days ago now, where 140 people were killed right off the cuff. Another 500 to 600 have been injured, some of them badly enough that they will probably not survive. So the entire escalation of the Saudi war in Yemen is going forward with full U.S. backing, U.S. support. In Libya, again in the context of the Arab Spring, a crisis in Libya that leads to a call for a familiar word, a no-fly zone. And first the call comes from various European powers. It's quickly taken up in the U.S. by the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and others in the State Department. Hillary Clinton, who's supposed to be at that time the diplomat in chief, you would think she would have been calling for a diplomatic solution, but no, she was the one leading the call for a no-fly zone. The Secretary of Defense, the head of the Pentagon, who one would think would be calling for the military side, he was the one saying, no, we shouldn't be engaging. Why? Because he said, establishing a no-fly zone in Libya starts with going to war against Libya. This is Robert Gates in whatever it was, April or May of 2011, the Secretary of Defense. The Republican, he was the holdover from the Bush administration. President Obama had kept him on. And he's the one saying, it means we have to go to war with Libya. Why? Because the first thing you have to do in establishing a no-fly zone is take out the anti-aircraft system so that your patrols will be safe. Now, Libya at that time barely had an anti-aircraft system of any significance. But nonetheless, they went forward. Secretary Gates' position was defeated. Secretary Clinton's position was the one that ruled the day. The U.S. joined NATO and in a massive bombing campaign that, of course, led to the overthrow and ultimately the murder of Gaddafi. And crucially for the regional situation, as well as inside Libya, led to the throwing open of the doors of massive arms depots throughout the country. Those arms have now surfaced all throughout Central Africa, North Africa, throughout the greater Arab world. Basically, in all these conflicts, there are now Libyan arms that have been made available to pretty much anybody. Inside Libya, massive instability and massive violence, three separate governments, none of whom have any indigenous credibility. One is recognized by the UN, but none of them are seen as representing a unified country. It's a disaster. The disaster is not about the Hillary Clinton emails about Benghazi. That's not the disaster. The disaster is for the people of Libya and what's happened to their country. A lot of people at the time said that a no-fly zone is going to lead to regime change. And in the UN Security Council, the same argument was made. And people were somehow convinced that, no, this is only about protecting civilians. This is not about regime change. And what a surprise. It got bad enough that the Secretary General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in South Africa, which voted for the resolution authorizing this so-called no-fly zone to protect civilians, later apologized, said we should have known better. We should have known it would not be limited to a no-fly zone to protect civilians, that it would become regime change, and indeed it did. Syria, the centerpiece now of the worst of all of this, also in the context of the Arab Spring, begins with a nonviolent protest movement of Syrians fed up with a very brutal dictatorial regime, looking for political reforms, an end to mass arrests, an end to torture in prison, exacerbated somewhat by conditions created by climate change. One, you know, in the Arab Spring was a regional phenomenon, but it took very different form in different countries. And in Syria, one of those forms had to do with climate change, because there had been a three-year drought that led 800,000 Syrian farmers and their families to be driven off the land. They could no longer make a living. They were forced into the cities looking for work. Until about 10 years earlier, they might have found jobs, because at that time, the Syrian economy was a kind of state socialism of a sort, with a very enormous bloated state sector that could, you know, hire pretty much anybody they wanted. About a decade before, it had turned into a kind of neoliberal economy where there was a great deal of privatization. The state sector had been vastly diminished. So people flood into the cities looking for work. There's hardly any jobs. The jobs they do find tend to go to people who know someone in power. That means they're more likely than not to be an Alawite, because that's the religious identity of the ruling family, of the Assad family, and their closest circles. It doesn't mean that only Alawites got jobs, but it just means that it exacerbated the sectarianism that had not been a big issue in Syria historically. Historically, Syria, modern Syria, had been quite secular. But suddenly, sectarianism was a big factor. So you see in Syria, with the rise of ISIS, first in Iraq, the rise of ISIS, of course, one of the consequences of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It emerged from a U.S.-run prison, Camp Buqqa, in Iraq, where hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of Iraqis were rounded up and imprisoned. And let me just ask you something about this. This happened in 2004, in the first year of the U.S. war in Iraq. And at the time that the group that became ISIS, it didn't use that name at first, it was attached to Al-Qaeda earlier, it was much less religiously focused in its earlier iterations. But at that time, it was the same time as the Abu Ghraib scandal emerged. Now let me ask the students here, how many of you have heard of Abu Ghraib? Just a couple of you. You should raise this with some of your faculty here, because that's a problem that you don't know more about Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib is something that will haunt United States foreign policy for generations. Abu Ghraib was a prison in Iraq, where Iraqis that were picked up by the U.S. occupation forces were held and interrogated, and it turns out, humiliated and tortured routinely by U.S. soldiers. This had been going on in other prisons as well. It wasn't unique to Abu Ghraib. What was unique was that a set of photographs were leaked from Abu Ghraib. And those photographs made it onto the front page of every newspaper in the country and around the world. And those photographs showed U.S. soldiers, very young U.S. soldiers, humiliating, helpless, often naked Iraqi prisoners, sometimes with a dog collar around their neck and held on a dog leash, sometimes forced to pile on top of each other in piles of naked men. It was unspeakable humiliations and unspeakable torture. Every Iraqi prisoner in a U.S. prison in those days knew that he might face the same torture. Not everyone was, but they all knew it could happen because it had happened, it had been documented, and the whole world now knew about it. It's now the symbol for Iraqis of what the U.S. occupation looked like. So in that context, that's what led to the creation of what became ISIS. ISIS becomes strong for some of the reasons I mentioned. Iraqis who are very secular in other ways, and some of them are generals, some of them have their arms, join with ISIS. They become much stronger than they would on their own. They're powerful because they don't fight alone. And suddenly they're over the border into Syria, wiping out the colonial border and saying, we are establishing this caliphate on territory across both Iraq and Syria. So the Syria war takes on this incredibly complex character. It's no longer just either a political or even an armed struggle between opposition forces and the regime. There's now both Syrian but especially regional Islamist forces, extremist forces flooding into Syria as well as into Iraq, and then global Islamist forces are coming in to join, to be part of this caliphate. So it complicates everything as we move towards the period where we see these proxy wars that I mentioned earlier. Now, there's a lot of mythology about the Syrian war. One is that the problem in Syria is that the U.S. isn't doing anything. The U.S. isn't intervening, and we need U.S. intervention. Well, it's a myth on a couple of fronts. Number one, the U.S. is right in there. The U.S. is bombing in eastern Syria. It's not bombing in Aleppo right now, which is very good because it would just be killing more people than the Russians and the Syrians are killing, and that's plenty. It's way too many already. But they are bombing, supposedly, against ISIS in eastern Syria. Now, the problem is what that means is, you know, you can't bomb terrorism. You can bomb people. You can bomb cities. Sometimes you can even bomb terrorists if you get lucky. But you can't bomb terrorism. And where ISIS is, there are people living there. They are living in cities. And the people in those cities have no ability to get out. So when we hear, and we hear this a lot about, we're getting ready for the attack on Mosul, we're getting ready for the attack on Raqqa. Those are the two kind of capitals of ISIS, Raqqa in Syria and Mosul in Iraq. Mosul is a city that once held about 2 million people. It now has, we think, somewhere around 675,000 people that are left. They can't get out. They can't get out. So when the U.S. starts to, quote, liberate Mosul with its bombers, ISIL will be able to get out. The people who live there will not. And that's who the people will be who will die. ISIS, I'm guessing, are going to get out, and they're going to scatter, and we're going to be hearing from them for a very long time. The same in Raqqa, inside of Syria. So one of the myths is the U.S. isn't doing anything, or it's not doing enough, where people mean militarily. The U.S. isn't doing a lot of stuff it needs to do. But the military problem is not that it's doing not enough, it's that it's doing too much of the wrong things. So that's one of the myths. There's another myth that says that everybody in the U.S. wants to, in U.S. government wants to overthrow the regime in Syria. That's a myth also. There are plenty of people in power in Washington and some who are out of power, the neoconservatives and others, who have long wanted to get rid of the regime in Syria. It's one of the seven countries that were on the famous list that surfaced in 2002 that the neocons had been distributing about the seven countries they want to overthrow. That's certainly true. The myth is that that's the only reason that there's anything bad going on in Syria. You hear this from some. Not taking into account that Syrians themselves rose up against a pretty terrible government and tried to change it. The other problem with that analysis is that it doesn't take into account the reality of what the government in Syria has been about. There, one of the other myths is that the government in Syria, the Assad family, father and son, who've been in power since 1970, that they represent some kind of a center of resistance, an arc of resistance in the Middle East, that they are against the West, they're against Israel, they support the Palestinians, they're the real upholders of Arab nationalism. Well, it turns out, when you look at the history, not so much. It doesn't work that way so much. So you can start from the time of the 1967, even before the Assad came to power, but certainly from then, Israel is occupying the Syrian Golan Heights, right? And the Syrian governments have made sure that the population was relatively quiescent, that the border stayed relatively quiet. Once in a while, there'd be a bit of a border skirmish, but those border skirmishes never resulted in full-scale war. Fast forward to 1976, the Syrian regime, in support of a right-wing Israeli-backed militia in Lebanon, launch a massive attack against the Palestinian refugee camp at Tel Azatar, killing a huge number of Palestinians. So this notion that they're all in the interest of Israel, they're against Israel and supporting the Palestinians kind of falls by the wayside. 1990, the U.S. is running around, President Bush the first, trying to get support for the first attack on Iraq, right? Operation Desert Storm. They want a coalition that includes Arabs to give them credibility. So they go to Damascus and say, will you join our coalition? And the answer is, sure, no problem. So Syrian Air Force fighter jets, fighter bombers, are sent to participate in the U.S. coalition bombing Iraq in 1991. 2003, in the global war on terror, the U.S. goes to Syria and says, can we outsource interrogation to you for detainees that we're picking up in the global war on terror? You're so good at interrogation. And the Syrians say, sure, why not? So one of those people is the Canadian citizen Maher Arar, who's arrested at Kennedy Airport, interrogated for 3 weeks by U.S. and Canadian officials. They think he's a terrorist. He can't confess to anything because, what a surprise, he doesn't have anything to confess to. But instead of sending him home, they ship him off to Syria, where he is held for almost a year in a dungeon, a coffin-sized dungeon, and tortured for almost a year. The Syrians can't get him to confess to anything because, what a surprise, he's got nothing to confess to. He's finally sent back to Syria, to Canada. The Canadians launch a big investigation to figure out maybe they did something wrong, and they determine, as a matter of fact, we did do something wrong. We identified the wrong person. He is absolutely exonerated. He is guilty of nothing. He is innocent, and they gave him $10 million in compensation for what he had suffered. The U.S. response, to this day, he is still on the no-entry list for the United States. My institute gave him one of our human rights awards, along with his lawyers from the Center for Constitutional Rights, back in 2006. And he couldn't come to Washington to accept the award. He had to do it by video because he's not allowed into the United States. That's the kinds of failures that are endemic to this so-called global war on terror. So what we're looking at now is a series of failures all around the region, calls to replicate some of those same failures. We're now hearing an escalating call for a no-fly zone in Syria. I always want to ask Secretary Clinton when she talks about it at the debates, so do you think that Secretary Gates was wrong when he said the first thing you have to do is go to war? Or are you saying you're fine with going to war explicitly against Syria, and now that means against Russia? Are you being really reckless, or do you really think he was wrong about this? You know, the problem is, there's another myth, that a no-fly zone sounds great. We need a no-fly zone where nobody is flying and nobody is dropping bombs. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about one side imposing a no-fly zone on the other and imposing it by bombing the planes or whatever that try to take off, who knows what. So it's a huge problem. It's not going to work. It's going to make everything worse. But it sounds like something you do by declaration. You know, you do it instead of bombing. Yay, a no-fly zone. Except that's not the military reality on the ground. So that's what we're facing. Now, I want to just talk about two more quick things and then open it up for discussion and whatever. The first is about the question of the domestic cost. You know, this is not only about how these things come back in what the CIA calls blowback, when an operation ends up biting you. You know, you get the consequences of it. One of the consequences of our global war on terror is that the U.S. is resented and hated in countries around the world for our bombing and killing people in those countries, for overthrowing governments that may have been very unpopular, but that local people don't necessarily think we should have had the right to overthrow, for all kinds of things. But there's also a very immediate economic cost. The current global war on terror, what President Obama calls the overseas contingency operation, is not nearly as expensive as the Iraq war under George Bush. That's true. We don't have 150,000 troops and another 100,000 U.S. contractors operating in Iraq, occupying the whole country. We have special forces, we have bombers, we have drones, we have all kinds of things. We don't have that. So the cost is not quite as much. But it's not chump change either. So when you think about this war that was started in 2014 against ISIS, that budget is kept completely separate from the Pentagon budget. You know, the Pentagon budget is its own thing. So the budget just for the war, just here in Massachusetts from 2014, you all, you taxpayers here, are paying $19,956 an hour, 24/7, for just that war against ISIS. And you've been paying it since August of 2014. That's a lot of money. Now, if you look at the Pentagon budget, the budget that doesn't include the war, doesn't include the nuclear weapons, they're in the Energy Department, doesn't include caring for veterans, only includes kind of keeping on the lights at the Pentagon, you know, keeping them in their bases around the world. Massachusetts taxpayers just this year are paying over $17 billion for that budget, for the Pentagon budget. Now, a billion, you know, you could say a gazillion and it would mean the same thing. I don't think anybody, are any of you math majors? No, okay. I'm not even sure if you were a math major you would know, but I certainly never really understood what, you know, what a billion is, or even a million. I will tell you one story. When I was I think in second or third grade, I had a teacher who came in one day with this giant piece of graph paper. You know, the kind with the really tiny squares that were like 10 to the inch. And she put it up on the board, and it went like through the whole blackboard. And she said, all right, you kids, I want you to look at this, because all your life, you're going to grow up hearing about a million this and a million that, and you're never going to have seen a million anything. So here you are. This is a million little squares. Look at it and remember, that's how many there are. And there were a ton of them. And that was a million, not a billion. We're talking billions here. So imagine. But even my little square analogy doesn't really say what it is. So here's a couple of trade-offs. If you were not spending that money on the Pentagon, here's what you could do with that same $17 billion. You could pay for 171,450 elementary school teachers for a year. You could provide 231,333 clean energy jobs. What would that do to the unemployment rate here in Massachusetts? You could get 1.6 million kids into Head Start, or you could provide health care to 4.6 million children. Now, you don't have to worry about kids having health care because you live in a state that actually provides health care. What a concept. Maybe I should move here. But in general, you get the idea of what that money could be used for. What's going to keep us safer? Jobs and health and education, or more money for the Pentagon? You know, this is a huge problem. So the last thing I want to say, and then we'll open it up, is about what we can do instead. You know, it's fine to say the military stuff doesn't work. What do we do instead? So there's a few answers. None of them are easy. None of them are guaranteed to work right away. None of them will work in the short term. We know that. We also know that the military stuff doesn't work in the short term. So we have to keep that in mind. And only one of the four has any chance of being implemented in the near term. Having said that, I will tell you what the four things are. There's more, but this is a start. Number one, start with what every medical student learns on her first day of medical school, the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. You know, they're taught when you have a patient, whatever else you do, don't make them sicker. If your goal is to stop ISIS or the Assad regime or Russia or whoever from killing people in Syria, stop killing people in Syria yourself. Pull out the troops, pull out the special forces, ground the bombers, bring them home, stop the military stuff. It's not doing anybody any good. It's making things worse and not better. You claim there's no boots on the ground, make it real. Get them out. And the sneakers, too, from the CIA and special forces. I don't think they wear boots. Number two, stop sending weapons to everybody and their brother who says they're fighting against ISIS or fighting against Assad or fighting whoever. This is the hardest one of all. Why? Because of the power of the military construct in this country. The people who make the bombs and build the planes and make the profits off of it, they're making a killing. So when you hear people say, well, no one wants this war, it's really not true. Most of us don't want this war. But there's a few people, very powerful people, who do. They're the ones who are making a profit off of it, who are selling the bombs and the planes and everything else to the Saudis and the Turks and the Jordanians and the Qataris and the UAE and everybody else, and sending them directly here too. It's not working. They all end up in the hands of the most extreme elements. So all this talk about, well, we're only sending it to the vetted, moderate, secular ones, you know, yeah, right, until they get run over by ISIS or whoever. Just stop doing that and move towards a full arms embargo. If we're serious about wanting the other side to stop arming the Syrian regime, for instance, you know, you hear U.S. officials saying, well, Russia and Iran must stop arming the Assad regime. Well, I agree with that. It's a terrible regime. They should stop arming them. But why do we think we have any credibility at all when we're sending arms to everybody else that's trying to overthrow the Assad regime? Who would listen to that? So it's got to be an arms embargo on all sides, and we can start that by stopping the arms shipments that's going to the rebels. Some of that's beginning to be talked about a little bit in the new pressure on Saudi Arabia that's happening in Washington. You know, the U.S. has sent, just under President Obama, $115 billion worth of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and they're using it illegally in Yemen and sending it off to be used illegally in Syria. This is a mess. Number three, we need new diplomacy, real diplomacy, and it's not going to be easy. Maybe something will happen on Saturday when there's this new diplomatic meeting that Secretary Kerry has called together. I'm not terribly optimistic, but that's worth hoping for at least. But we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war and not just aimed at being more efficient in the bombing, which was one of the big problems in that last U.S.-Russia agreement that collapsed after about a week. it wasn't aimed at stopping the war. It was aimed at dividing one group of rebels from another so the U.S. and the Russians could go in together and bomb everybody. They want to bomb ISIS. They want to bomb Al-Qaeda. But they don't want to bomb the others. You know, this is not going to work. You can't have diplomacy that's aimed at better bombing and think that's going to lead to an end to the war. So we need real diplomacy that's aimed at ending the war. The fourth, and the only one that I think we might have a chance of getting somewhere soon, has to do with the humanitarian crisis. You all know some of the statistics. Half the population of Syria has been displaced from their homes in the last 5 years. 10 million of them. It's a number that's just staggering. Half, meaning it's actually a little more than half, about 6 million are displaced within Syria. 5.5 million or so are refugees outside of Syria, overwhelmingly in the countries surrounding Syria. There is a huge refugee crisis in places like Lebanon, where now one out of every three or four people in the country is a Syrian refugee. 1/4 to 1/3 of the population in the country. It's as if 150 million Canadians were somehow dropped in our shores with nothing but the shirt on their back, no food, no water, no education plans for their kids, no job, no nothing, and we suddenly are responsible for taking care of them. You know, that's the crisis in Lebanon. In Jordan, a country that doesn't have sufficient water for its own population, is now dealing with over 1 million Syrian refugees. This is a refugee crisis. Here, we don't have a refugee crisis here. We have a racism crisis here that's prohibiting more refugees from coming. And I've got to say, one of the outrages right now is to hear our government officials bragging, proud of our taking 10,000, a measly 10,000 refugees over an entire year, who have all spent about 2 years being vetted and another year before that in a refugee camp being vetted by the UN before they even get to the vetting process that we impose. And 78% of them are women and children, and they're still taking 2 years or so to be vetted by the U.S. And we're proud of that? Germany last summer was taking twice that daily, and we're proud of taking 10,000 in a year? So we need a real campaign here to say we want Syrian refugees, not because, well, don't worry, we'll make sure that it's only the good guys and we'll make sure they're safe. You know, it's because we want to welcome them. We're a country that claims to be based on refugees. You know, the give us your tired, your poor, unless they're Muslim or Arab. It's shocking. It's not maybe surprising, but it's shocking that our attitude has turned into such xenophobia and Islamophobia that's so bound up with this anti-refugee position. So we need a campaign to build support for refugees and build support for ending the war, not winning the war. Nobody's going to win this war. But we need a campaign that says we've got to end it. That means an arms embargo. Doesn't happen soon, but we got to start talking about it so eventually it will. Thank you.